Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, here to welcome you to Valley Writers Read, where all the stories you hear are written by folks who either live in or hail from the San Joaquin Valley. Tonight, a story by Hope Knisley, who, although she lives in Reedley now, originally came from the Midwest and lived for a few tumultuous years in Oakland. And that's what her story is about, the years she lived in Oakland on a street called Bella Vista, Beautiful View. And that's also the name of her story, Bella Vista. And here she is, Hope Knisley, to read her story for us.
I got the blues for my baby down by the San Francisco Bay. An ocean liner took him so far away. Well, I didn't mean to treat him so bad. You know he was the best man that I ever had. You know what he said, goodbye, likely to make me cry. I've got to lay down and die, yeah, yeah. And ain't got a nickel and I ain't got a lousy dime, yeah.
Bella Vista. In that amorphous landscape of time that made up our lives between college and our unknown futures, we exchanged Midwestern quietude and stability for life in the Bay Area. In one of the more memorable quotes about Oakland, Gertrude Stein declared, "There is no there there." For us, however, Oakland was that special there that came in a time of need. Being new to three of us, Oakland had that je ne sais quoi, the there, that Stein had not found when she returned to her childhood home. We arrived in Oakland in a game of road trip musical chairs. We came part by design, part by default. Doug was there first, a 1980 refugee out of Fresno. A few years later, Jill, Kevin, and I crisscrossed the West from Iowa City to Oakland in a way one can only do in their 20s, with little money, lots of caffeine, time to spare, and no real destination. It was early October when I helped load Jill's cherry red Volkswagen with all her earthly goods, and we drove from Iowa City to Oakland by way of the Grand Canyon, the Arizona desert, and San Diego. She settled in with Doug, and I left. Upon returning to Iowa City, I began to feel the pull of the unknown. After all, job hunting was going to be stressful wherever I did it. It might as well be there. In turn, Kevin helped me drive Interstate 80 from Iowa City to its end point near the Bay Bridge in Oakland, 36 hours straight through. Less than a month later, he returned on his motorcycle to move in with us. We were all together on Bella Vista in time for Christmas. The fall that we moved into the blocky, mustard-yellow, stucco apartment building on Bella Vista was a bit unsettling on the national scene. Rock Hudson died of AIDS, Sylvester Stallone had dinner at the White House, and Richard Nixon was chosen to arbitrate a baseball dispute. After the Geneva summit that fall, President Reagan informed us that he had told Gorbachev that their task would be easier if extraterrestrials would invade. That way they'd be on the same side. In other words, it was an erratic time. Even in our uprooted state, these things registered. Our inner insecurities were only compounded by the national insanity and our slightly berserk Bella Vista environment. By the time I arrived around Thanksgiving, Doug and Jill had found the apartment on Bella Vista. We had a sweet deal, a large two-bedroom apartment for four people for a mere $450. This was the mid-1980s, and housing costs were climbing. We knew a great deal when we saw one. The manager, Rumi, did not care what we paid or even if we paid. He just took our monthly checks and took care of the place. or at least he sort of took care of the place. We had to ask for things steadily, day after day. Eventually, he would show up drunk, with tools in hand, to take care of the problem of the week. Rumi was a gentleman even when sloshed. As long as we would listen, he would talk, although most of it was the gibberish of the inebriated. He lived below us with his cousin Mackie and Mackie's girlfriend Dodie. We usually commissioned Doug to deliver our rent checks because he had more patience than the rest of us for Rumi's drunken ramblings. Up close and personal, the smell of alcohol was overwhelming, the garbled chatter exasperating, and the dingy interior of their apartment depressing. Part of every month, Rumi would be gone. Upon return, he would comment conspiratorially, complete with a wink, to Doug,
"Been doing my duty with the Merchant Marines."
That was his euphemism for nights he spent in jail, a regular occurrence. Rumi was an occasional fisherman who supplemented his steady diet of alcohol with San Francisco Bay, halibut, perch, and sea bass. In season or out, he would come home with a supply that he was more than happy to share with us. He insisted. They were never cleaned and gutted, so I, the fisherman's daughter, got the opportunity to practice a skill that I never particularly wanted to learn in the first place. Doug was vegetarian, but the rest of us had a few good fish dinners, even knowing that, at certain times of the year, it was illegal. Whenever Doug handed Rumi our rent checks, he was rewarded with the same greeting. "Hey, Einstein," Rumi would blubber. "Sit down, talk to me." A would-be philosopher, Rumi was impressed with Doug's mathematics degree, hence the name Einstein. He tried to engage Doug in philosophical discussions, quoting Descartes, but philosophical discussions with a worn-down drunk are a bit futile. Mostly, he just repeated, "I think, therefore I am," accompanied by maniacal laughter like it was a profound thing he just said. We never figured out if Rumi was a name given at birth or whether he had once been seen by family and friends as a budding poet. Currently, his poetry was limited to a few dirty limericks and occasional recitations of The Cremation of Sam McGee. We asked him if he liked it because President Reagan had quoted it for the Queen Mother. Rumi only stared blankly at us and continued, "There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold." Of the three, Dodie was the youngest, but it was impossible to decipher her age. The two men were older and of equally indeterminable years. Decades of drinking had distorted their features, giving each an ancient visage. Both men were happy when they were drunk, which was most of the time between 6 a.m. and midnight. They were sappy and a bit annoying at times, but they were never mean. Dodie, on the other hand, was not a sweet drunk, and the two men trembled in her presence and warned us to stay away from her. "Oh, you don't want to get in Dodie's way when she's drunk," Mackie told us more than once, "'cause when Dodie gets to cuttin'—" At this point, his voice would trail off ominously, leaving us to imagine what we would. There was only one time when Dodie turned happy, and it was not on booze, but on PCP. Her belligerence was never as terrifying as that. In a euphoric state, she swung herself around the one small tree on the front grassy patch, a spot of green that could hardly be called a yard. We watched out our front window while she clung to the trunk, skipping around it for hours, all the while she was giggling and singing, "Ring around the rosy," in a little girl voice. It was a bit like a really bad B-movie, and the whole time it was easy to envision her pulling out her cutting knife at any moment. The two men huddled together on the porch, watching her. This was the only time prior to Rhonda's return when we saw them completely subdued, minus all poetry and laughter. We waited until Dodie crashed before venturing out. After sleeping it off, Dodie returned to her normal, cantankerous persona, screaming epithets at the men and ignoring us unless she didn't like where we had parked. If we dared to look at her when we passed in the yard or on the porch, she would snarl, "What are you looking at?" We never answered, and she never expected us to. All she wanted was for us to stay out of her way. Clearly, we were not in Iowa anymore.
And he said, "Hey, you talking to me? Are you just practicing for one of those performances of yours? Hot language, it's a virus. Let me
Despite the nondescript exterior, our new apartment had character in a 1920s East Oakland style. It had wood floors, large airy rooms that let in the Bay Area sunshine in spring and fall, and a back porch. True, the back porch looked out on a weed lot with a few abandoned cars, but it was three stories up, at the back anyway, and if we sat in just the right place, all we could see was the skyline, and beyond that, the bay. Sunsets from that porch absolutely blew our socks off, as long as we didn't look down. This was Oakland, and in Oakland, life was integrated in a way one seldom experienced in U.S. cities. That included ethnicity, race, and class. Up the street from us lived a city councilman, while next door was a family that had been homeless and on the streets until they moved in here. The cars out back recorded a more prosperous time for someone in our building. A door-free, rusted-out BMW sat amid a sea of weeds taller than any of us. We talked about turning it into a planter, but talk is cheap, and we had better things to do. Entertainment came at bargain basement rates on Bella Vista. Rumi, Mackie, and Doty participated in an endless cycle of drunken binges, during which the men would fight with Doty, attempt to make up with her, and then would come the inevitable climax. Doty would call the police to report that the men were drunk and beating on her, although it was more likely that she was beating on them. The police would come, try to calm the crying men, then haul one or both off to jail. We would listen, pondering whether we should intervene on their behalf, but it never seemed like a good idea. While the men were being pushed into the back seat of the cop car, Doty would often be wailing, "Don't take them, officers, they'll be good now." When Mackie would return a few days later, he would soberly describe the experience. "When the cop asked my name, I told him, then whack!" He would demonstrate the descent of the nightstick on his back, including the sound effects of metal on skin. He had scars to show for it, and a chuckle that bordered on bitter. Even so, he appeared happy enough. He would endure Doty's harassment for a while, exchange it for police brutality, occasionally wander the streets for a few days, then return home again to Bella Vista. At the onset of an argument, you could find us with our ears to the floor trying to catch the gist of its content. There was a cinematic quality in hearing Doty cream the men for God knows what while they valiantly tried to defend themselves. They were no match for her, no matter how hard they tried or how sober they were. When Rumi, Mackie, and Doty were not arguing, they were listening to the radio and dancing away their drunkenness. Whatever music they played, they cranked it to top volume. Fortunately, it was usually a good mix of Motown tunes, but even that got tiring when it lasted all night. At our breaking point, when we desperately desired sleep, Doug set up his electronics equipment in the dining room. He had souped up the Beat oscillator, a part of the radio previously unknown to the rest of us, and used the automatic frequency diode for modulation. In doing this, he could effectively jam their radio station. With our ears to the floor, we could hear them puzzling over what happened to the broadcast. With laughter, we rolled on the floor above them while they located a new station. After a few minutes of music from the next station, giving them enough time to ramp up their dancing and singing yet again, Doug would jam that station and we would lie down to catch their bewilderment. They began with Motown, but with our helpful interference, they would run the gamut of 1980s music from Cyndi Lauper to Run DMC to Michael Jackson, Madonna, and the Talking Heads. When they would get back to Motown, we would leave them alone once again. The Bay Area met my own private need of seeing spatially, like a map. With an abundance of hills, we could pick our bird's eye view of choice. From Merritt College, or the Lawrence Hall of Science, or Indian Rock, we could see the layout of the cities and their streets. From Albany to Oakland, across the bay to San Francisco, past Angel Island and Alcatraz to the Golden Gate, and on around to the Marin Coast and Mount Tam. I needed that, as only a Midwesterner could. It was a real-life map, something I craved for my personal future as well. With entertainment all around us on Bella Vista, we still found time to take in the plethora of opportunities around the Bay Area. On the weekend, we flew kites at the Berkeley Marina or rode BART to the Ashby Station Flea Market. There we followed the thump of the bongo drums, the sweet aroma of barbecued goat meat and frying falafels. We explored stalls filled with brilliant scarves, funky furniture, and assorted wooden masks. My favorite was the art dealer with an overflowing basket of photographs and slides culled from many discarded family albums. There were families at the Hoover Dam and in front of the Eiffel Tower. There were the ubiquitous mugshots with people sticking out their tongues or holding pets, kids grinning from tricycle seats, and all the usual blurred memories of the mundane and the grand that fills everyday lives. Walking Telegraph Avenue was its own world. At one end, the angry transvestite held court in the median, sporting fishnet nylons and full beard, screaming, "I hate you!" to one and all. Wandering toward campus, we passed People's Park, stopping to inspect the mural depicting Mario Savio and the free speech movement. Reagan's role in this story was new to me. Juxtaposed with the current emerging of the Arms for Hostages deal, it was opening up a deepening political awareness. Closer to campus, Rick Starr crooned love songs through his plastic amp. The Polka Dot Man hung out, and Julia the Poet blew bubbles and read poetry. Once we got really lucky and saw Lawrence Ferlinghetti walking into Cafe Mediterranean. Although we had just finished a cup of coffee there, we walked back in for a prolonged sight of an ordinary famous person who drank Java where we drank Java. And the smells, the patchouli and cannabis, the ever-present fragrance of the non-native eucalyptus trees, the robust smokiness of Pete's coffee, these smells signified so much. A unique place, a life beginning, and the encouragement of secret dreams. After a weekend day spent wandering these places, we would stop off for a cheap meal at our favorite Indian restaurant, the one with the largest masala dosas around. There, waiting for our food, we would drift, just being and feeling and forgetting. While we watched, Doug poured salt from the shakers onto the table. Spreading it around, he would slowly develop someone's face in the grains on the curry-stained table while we guessed who it was. His art was ephemeral, to be swept off the canvas with the arrival of dinner when we stuffed ourselves with South Indian starches. During the languid afternoons, we walked to the neighborhood library and checked out Doris Lessing books to wade through. Making our way to a Mexican place on MacArthur Boulevard, we discovered aguas that could not be rivaled then or now. On occasion, we ate breakfast at Smoky Joe's, watching Ned make our plates of holy moly frijoli and urban cheese omelet. This was the place, according to Ned's sign, where the elite meet to eat no meat. Then there was the other sign at the back, the one that read, "Thank you for smoking, pot." With a few more spare dollars, we went to the Rialto, or the Berkeley Rep. At the one, you could hardly hear the soundtrack if it began to rain on the corrugated tin roof. At the other, you had to put up with dogs, people could bring their pets, seats without bottoms, and an ever-present stench. Ah, but the movies we could see there. Everything from Laura and North by Northwest to John Waters films to Attack of the Killer Tomatoes or Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster. This was living. Without knowing what direction we wanted our lives to head, we had found a great place to wait it out. A Bella Vista Christmas had a faintly surreal edge to it. Below us, our new neighbors played Christmas music like they played all their music at top volume. Trouble was, the only thing they played was the Temptations' Christmas album. In itself, that would have been okay, but it was rare that they got through the entire repertoire. Time after time, someone would lift the needle and return it to Silent Night. We could not jam a record player. It was a Christmas of a lot of firsts. The season passed without silence, accompanied constantly by the blasting command to sleep in heavenly peace. If anything, Rumi, Mackie, and Dodi stepped up their drinking, and Rumi invited us to enter the spirit of the season by sharing some hot mulled wine with them. It was my first Christmas away from my family and my first green, rainy Christmas. It was the first I knew, or wanted to know, that there were Christmas lines in Sam McGee, which Rumi dutifully repeated for our benefit. On a Christmas day, we were mushing our way over the Dawson Trail. Talk of your cold through the parka's fold, it stabbed like a driven nail. With Christmas coming, we had to find jobs quickly. Among the four of us, we had degrees in music, history, religion, English, political science, mathematics, and Spanish. Those degrees, while fun in the making, were not yet pointing us in a particular direction and lacked any special money-making magic. They did, however, provide us with a vast body of knowledge and the ability to analyze movies with erudite, literary, and political references. Unfortunately, no one offered to pay us for that. Finding jobs was a bit of a challenge, but eventually we all landed something, or more accurately, a series of somethings. The future lawyer among us, the poli-sci and Spanish major, wound up driving for the Berkeley City bus system. The computer programmer, the English major, became an overworked, underpaid paralegal. The hardware designer, music and math major, was an engineering assistant. I, who went on to become an archivist, history and religion major, tried my hand as an intake counselor at a homeless women's shelter. Before these jobs materialized, however, we took turns being employed by a marketing research company that sent desperate peons like us on observation trips to local grocery stores to check on various companies' test markets. After a few days driving wildly from one Safeway to the next, determining if each one was providing enough space for a new spaghetti sauce or displaying Aussie bears prominently, we counted the products and shelf space in our sleep. For this job, we needed our own transportation. We were paid by the number of stores we were able to visit. Stores spread from one end of the Bay Area to the other. It didn't take long to realize that the money we made barely paid for the gas we burned. Astride his motorcycle, Kevin fared a bit better, but even for him it was a stretch. The capitalist system has this wonderful and terrible edge, keeping people happy to have a job while not being able to cover the bare necessities. We did, however, get a nice supply of spaghetti sauce and Aussie bears for personal consumption. It could have been worse, we assured each other. We could have been the poor suckers who were mascots for the Aussie bears. Aussie bears were a gooey chocolate and caramel candy product shaped like koala bears made by an Australian company that was attempting to expand into a U.S. market. With peace offerings of company products, we were set temporarily. Dinner, spaghetti sauce, and dessert, Aussie bears, and all we had to buy was the spaghetti to go under the sauce. More than 20 years passed before we all confessed to each other, at a birthday party when one of us turned 50, that we never again walked down the pasta aisle of any supermarket without averting our eyes, trying not to count the rows. With homelessness a mounting issue in the mid-1980s, shelters were opening in quick succession around the Bay Area. I applied to Catholic Charities and became an intake counselor for a women's shelter. If nothing else, this job confirmed for me that my shift from a social work degree to the study of history had been the right move. Also, it contributed to the feeling of insanity that brewed around us. One evening, after a particularly nasty, screaming match below, we heard the shatter of glass. Leaving our dinner to get cold, we ran to the front window to see what this show would bring. Airborne dishes were hurtling from the porch toward Mackie and Rumi, who were running out in the street, dodging the projectiles. They didn't go far, however, just out of throwing distance. Dodie's pitching arm was amazingly strong and accurate. In their eternal optimism, the men begged Dodie to let them back in the house. We couldn't see her, but we could hear Dodie's rasping curses emanating from the porch below us. The dishes kept flying, and Dodie stood firm, calling the men vile names and insisting they could never return. It was several weeks before the broken pieces were cleaned up. We simply stepped over them as we came and went. Whatever prompted this outburst, Dodie banished Rumi to his pickup camper, which set out front. This was not his favorite spot because his wife, never seen by any of us, lived there. Rumi took her a plate of food every evening. Opera music escaped her windows. She particularly loved Turandot. To live with her for a few days was difficult for Rumi on many levels. He hated opera. Dodie knew how he felt. It was worse even than a night in jail. Dodie gave Mackie a choice. He could sleep under the tree or in the BMW out back. He protested. He begged her to let him sleep with her. He promised her the best night of her life. Dodie went for the phone. Mackie chose the tree, but not before another round of begging her for her forgiveness. Beside us, the man who worked at Pac Bell regularly beat his wife until someone, sometimes us, called the police. This neighbor's kid was eerily quiet and too scared to talk much. Once Kevin convinced him to join him on a motorcycle ride. He almost smiled. The family moved away before we did. We kept working our crappy little jobs while trying to ignore our futures and lack of direction. From the day we moved into our apartment on Bella Vista Avenue, Rumi told us that she would return. It was a long time before we knew who she was, and we didn't give it much thought. In retrospect, there was not much we could have done other than move out before this ghostly woman returned. When Rumi spoke of her, his accompanying shudder could have passed for either fear or anticipation. It was, we found out, a bit of both. Rumi kept assuring us, but she's good people, good people. We never even caught her name until she reappeared on Bella Vista. Whoever she was somewhere out there while we were here in an apartment with low rent and all the diversion we needed from our own flailing lives. It was the night of our one and only game of strip poker when Rhonda Means materialized. I don't believe there was any direct correlation, although it has occurred to me that this might have been a penance foisted on us by a deity with a sardonic wit. Maybe for the poker game, perhaps for tormenting our neighbors by jamming their radio stations. Toward the end of our poker game, we heard new voices downstairs. The cards lay forgotten as we pressed our ears to the floor. The sounds were all wrong. Dodie was quiet, almost subservient. The men sounded sober. There was no laughter, no screaming, no anger, just cadenced talk about the apartment and its inhabitants. From time to time, Rumi would begin, "It's good to have you home, Rhonda," but he was always cut short. The next morning, Rumi stopped us to say that Brenda Means was home. This was the woman he had been waiting for, the love of his life. This was the good people he had blubbered about in drunken anticipation. When Doug went down with the rent check, Rumi was alone and asked him to sit down. Doug asked about Rhonda, who she was and why she was here. Rhonda owned our building. It was apparent to us that Rumi was her minion, the one commissioned to manage her affairs in her absence. He was proud of the honor. Rhonda, however, accorded his position no respect. Doug asked where Rhonda had been all this time. Lowering his voice, Rumi explained, "In addition to our apartment building, Rhonda owned several others. Like her name, she was a woman of some means. We, however, came to associate her name with the other meaning. She was spiteful in a hardened way that none of us had seen before." Furthermore, Rumi offered a thinly veiled warning that she had just gotten out of prison. He paused before his revelation. She was caught burning another apartment building for the insurance money, with the other renters in it. Rumi was a bit vague about how the other renters fared in the fire, but we assumed that if she was out of prison after a few years, no one had died. Doug drove straight to the hardware store to buy several rope ladders, which we placed in strategic locations while we contemplated our next move. Rumi referred to her as my woman, but, we noticed, not when Rhonda was within earshot. Everyone was wary in her presence. Dodie, the same woman who could get to cutting on most people, simply disappeared. Whenever we saw her before she left, she had her head down and her mouth shut. No more curses at the men. No more "what are you looking at's" flung in our general direction. The ordered chaos to which we had become accustomed gave way to a different atmosphere. We did not make the transition readily. It was clear there would be no peaceful coexistence with Rhonda Means. Rhonda immediately raised the rent and threatened to sic her lawyer on us if we did not pay up immediately. No matter how we reasoned, she had one stock reply fired in a staccato bellow, "That's not the point!" Rhonda summed up her view of humanity in one oft-repeated sentiment. "Hate punks! Hate 'em!" she would scream at us, at Rumi and Mackie, at anyone who crossed her path. Whenever we left the apartment or returned, she filled her doorframe, hurling invectives and threats that made Dodie's offerings pale in comparison. There was only one way she was silent when we encountered each other. Rhonda never doled out her vitriol when Doug was at her sides. Any other combination of the rest of us elicited her finest hisses and threats. A black woman herself, she hated all women and all black men. Although she was not cordial with Doug or other white men, she managed a bit of civility with him. He was our one hope, the only way we could be assured she would leave us alone. Without him, her cold anger was flung at us in a myriad of ways. In fear, we stepped up our search for other apartments. There was no place, however, like Bella Vista. We couldn't stay, but neither could we really afford another place. At one juncture, when we still believed that discourse might be possible, we again tried to talk to her about a graduated rising rent. As we left the room with her emphatic, "Not on your life!" ringing in our ears, Kevin must have done something to anger her beyond normal. We never knew what it was, a mere shrug of the shoulder, a slight rolling of his eyes, but she was insulted and screamed us up the stairs. We could hear her continuing outrage as she badgered Rumi, asking him to protect her honor. Why she asked for his guard when she could protect herself far better than he could was beyond us. Within minutes, we could hear them tramping up the stairs, Rumi and Rhonda, to knock on our door. Rumi demanded to see Kevin. With the rest of us clustered behind him, Kevin faced a drunken Rumi, ready to defend his woman from all perceived wrongdoing. In a drunken boxer's dance, he jabbed half-heartedly in Kevin's direction. Rhonda planted herself like a boulder on the stair steps behind him, effectively eliminating his escape route. "You messing with my woman," Rumi continued his pugilistic farce with an exaggerated wink to assure us that he meant us no harm. "'Cause if you're messing with my woman, I'm going to have to hurt you." He continued his feints on the landing while we stood in amused silence, trying not to get him killed by the woman who wanted everyone within a mile of her dead. We stepped up our apartment searches, recognizing that even if it stretched our finances, we had to get out quickly. Late one evening, Rhonda brought some potential renters up to see the place, four bright-eyed college students. Their exclamations indicated their approval of the apartment. Rhonda was on her best behavior, her voice filled with honey. When one student headed for the kitchen, Jill followed. "You might want to consider this carefully," Jill told her. "Talk to us if you want to know why." Later that night, they called us and we explained. When the students told Rhonda that they had found something else, she roared up the stairs demanding to know what the hell we had done to scare them away. By now, she was threatening to get her lawyer for many reasons. We were breaking our contract. We had not taken proper care of the place. We scared away potential renters. We hadn't met her lawyer yet, and we hoped we never would. We found other apartments, separating ourselves into two couples. We missed the show on Bella Vista. Life went on, but it was never quite so lively again. A month later, we spotted a notice in the paper advertising a renovated Victorian house with rooms for rent. The address was our old place on Bella Vista. We even drove by just for old time's sake and looked at the hulking mass of concrete, which she labeled Victorian. Several years passed and we left Bella Vista and the Bay Area far behind us. Jill and Kevin moved back to the Midwest to go to law school. Doug and I loaded our Toyota, our possessions still fit in one compact car, and headed for Washington, D.C. We began to work on graduate degrees and steered our way into full-blown adulthood. Reagan's 80s became the Bush and Clinton 90s. The Iran-Contra affair climaxed. Fawn Hall shredded important documents. Monica Lewinsky came into the limelight and left again. Apartheid fell in South Africa. Welfare reform was implemented and national health care blew up in our faces. We protested the Gulf War and began to have children. We bought Apple computers and entered the age of the Internet. Some parts of our lives began to make sense, while other things arrived to confound us. We struggled with our studies, with career moves, with parenthood. And we missed Bella Vista. In time, we all came back to California, albeit to new places, to San Diego and Fresno instead of Oakland. Our children began to grow up, and we immersed ourselves in, and also switched, our chosen professions. We continued to get together to celebrate birthdays and Thanksgiving. We now have other stories to tell, but always we return to the tales of Bella Vista and the glorious mess of our lives that we led in Oakland. We make periodic pilgrimages back to our street, relieved to have that time behind us, but essentially happy to have been there. Once Doug and I took our kids, they yawned, looking puzzled as we cruised slowly down Bella Vista. Sitting on the stools at Smoky Joe's, once again watching Ned make our omelets, one of them pointed out, with considerable surprise, the prevalence of bongs, and wondered aloud whether we, their aging parents, really had hung out in this place. More recently, as Doug and I ate breakfast overlooking Durant Avenue, we mentioned Rumi, Dodie, and Mackie. How did they, we asked, experience life in the 21st century, in this time of endless war? A real estate nightmare, stores and companies vying to depict themselves as green in the midst of a world food crisis. Are they still listening to Motown? Are they even together? Have they survived? But we never once pondered the whereabouts of Rhonda Means.
Take it all for free.
That was Hope Knisley reading Bella Vista, Beautiful View. And while the natural scenery in the world is awesome, sometimes inspiring, like the view from the house these young people were renting, it's really the people, their stories, and their ways of dealing with each other which makes life so fascinating. Hope Knisley describes her neighbors with candor and truthfulness. Yes, she admits their obvious weaknesses and faults, but never loses sympathy and appreciation for their kindness, humor, and love. It's so easy to write off neighbors, so easy to ignore and dislike them, and by doing so, add just a little more distance and enmity between class, ethnicity, race, when the act of bending a little, showing a little tolerance and understanding could bring all of us just a little closer. You know, it isn't for nothing that our writer tonight bears the first name, Hope. Friends, Hope Knisley currently lives in Reedley. She's an exciting writer who recently won first runner-up in the creative nonfiction category of the William Saroyan Centennial Prize competition. The piece she wrote was called Heat, Pain, and Life in the Valley. We extend our congratulations to her and hope that maybe she's working on another exciting story for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read programs, just go online at kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our reader will be Dave Creighton. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a weekly series produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk for Valley Public Radio. Please join us again next Wednesday at the same time for another edition of Valley Writers Read.